Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Mem Chen Mad Bet, 10 lines up, where it says, Tabi tala le papi a kinoro. Tabi strung up papi on a kinara. A kinara is a tree. It's not clear here from what type of tree it is. There are those that say that it's the jujube tree. Others say that it was an avocado tree. The way that Rashbam brings down one interpretation, which would seem to follow thematically in the Gemara, is that Tabi went ahead and strung up papi on a tree. And forced him or compelled him to sell him some tract of land or some piece of land. The Rashbam brings an alternate explanation which says that he strung him up in order to have him sell him this particular tree or give him this particular tree. Again, that would be a varied version of what we've seen until now, though the first explanation we brought in the name of the Rashbam seems to thematically be a continuation of what we've seen in the Gemara, which is tell you, they string him up, vizavin, and he ends up selling it, zvinei zvini, that his sale is a good sale. And that's what it seems to be talking about here. So Tabi tala la papi a kinara vizavin, and he sold him whatever it was, whether it was the tree or the tract of land. Chotam Rabba Bar Bar Chana amoda'a va'ashkauta. Rabba Bar Bar Chana signed on two documents. One document was a moda'a, which we bumped into back on Daf Mem, which is a document indicating that the person is selling under duress, and that he wants people to know that the only reason he sold it, or the only reason that he possibly signed onto something is because he was compelled to do so, and he wants to annul any action that he takes after this point in time. So he brings Edim together and explains to them what's happening, and they understand and are aware of the duress that he's under, and that is a moda'a. And a shkauta is a document of sale. It's a document that grants the buyer the right to the property. So here, Rabbi Bar Chana signed on both documents. He signed both on the document that declared this being a sale under duress, but then he also signed on the document itself that was the sale document. Amar Rav Huna, mandachatim amoda'a shapir chatim, mandachatim ashkalta shapir chatim. The one who signed on the moda'a signed properly, and the one who signed on the document of sale also signed properly. Amar says, manofshach. Wait a minute, that is contradictory. These are mutually exclusive documents. You can't have two documents signed and both be verified and valid documents, because one of them says that the document of sale was done under duress. Another one says that there was a sale over here. Imoda'a, if the moda'a is a valid document, meaning the one that says it was under duress, lo ashkauta, then you don't have a proper document of sale. Be ashkauta, and if you do have a document of sale, lo moda'a, then the moda'a is not meaningful because then whatever declaration was made was invalid. So the assumption here being that this is speaking about the same transaction, and in the same transaction, which is what happened over here, Rabbi Bar Chana signed both on a moda'a and on ashkauta. And Rav Huna comes along and says that the signing of both of these documents was valid. The Gemara is bothered by that. How can you have both documents be valid in this situation? They're mutually exclusive positions that the documents uphold. It says, Achikamar, Ilav moda'a, mandachotim ashkalta shapir chatim. That were it not for the moda'a, the document declaring that this was done under duress, then the document of sale would be a valid document. And that follows Rav Huna's position, the Rav Huna the Tamei, Tam Rav Huna, tell you, Vizavin, Zvinei zvini, that if a person is compelled under duress to make a sale, if he receives the proper remuneration for that sale, then it's considered to be a valid sale, even though it was done under duress, because we say, agavunse, because of the pressure, gomer makne. He came to the conclusion that it was worthwhile or he really wanted to sell it, and he sells it because he's getting the proper compensation and consideration for that which he's selling. So given that, the sale without the moda'a would have been a valid sale document, and then the moda'a comes and upends the sale document. So in the end, what it's saying is that the signing of the documents, each one of these documents could be a valid document. If it was just a sale under duress, then the sale document would have been a valid document. If it's a sale under duress that is preceded by a moda'a, which is a signed document which says that whatever I'm doing after this is under duress, that's also a valid document. And in different situations, each one of those would be independently valid. In our situation, where Rabbi Bar Chana signed on both of these documents, the moda'a that preceded the sale would upend the sale document, and therefore the moda'a would govern in this situation. The other thing that you learn from here, which is important, is that even though Rabbi Bar Chana had signed on moda'a, there's no problem with him signing on the sale document. There's nothing improper about signing on this sale document, and therefore it wasn't problematic, even though he knew it was done under duress, and he knew there was a moda'a out there, that it was okay for him to go ahead and then sign on the sale document. Because signing on the sale document does not, in any way, undermine that which was accomplished in putting the moda'a together. The moda'a is put in place in order to annul any future document, and therefore signing on the sale document afterwards will not weaken the power of that moda'ah or undermine that moda'ah. Given that, there's no restriction against signing on the sale document, on the ashkauta, and that's what Rav Huna was saying over here. So you see a number of things here. Number one is Rav Huna's din, that if one makes a sale under duress, that it is a valid sale. From here we see that Rav Huna does qualify that and say that if there is a moda'ah, if there is a document saying or in telling us that it was done under duress, that would govern or that would supersede the fact that a sale under duress is considered to be a valid sale. That's number one. Number two is that a witness that signs both on the moda'ah and on the sale document does nothing to undermine the moda'ah, the declaration that the documents being signed after this are all being done under duress, thereby permitting an aid to sign on both documents, and in doing so not hurting the standing or the tokef of the moda'ah that preceded the sale document over here. Now the Gemara wants to challenge this idea more fundamentally and says, "Ini, is that really true?" Amar Rav Nachman, didn't Rav Nachman tell us, Edim Shamru Amana Hayud Dvarenu? If Edim come after the fact, they had signed on a contract, they show up after the fact, and now they tell us, Amana Hayud Dvarenu. That document was not really a document of a loan or a document of a sale. It was a document that was done under trust, which means that they wrote a document on behalf of a creditor, which said that the creditor would not exercise the document unless the money was actually lent. And the Love, the debtor over there, trusted the creditor to hold on to such a document. And now the Edim show up in court, and the creditor is trying to exercise his rights under this document. And the Edim say, when we wrote or signed on this document, it was not a valid document. It was simply a document in case of the future lending of money that it could be exercised. So in a sense, they're invalidating the document. Ein emanim. They are not believed in that case. Modayu dvarenu. The document that we sign on as witnesses, they are witnessing a document that they knew that was being signed under duress. The party to whose detriment this document is being signed was doing it under duress. We don't believe them in that case. They are not believed. So you see over here that Edim do not have the power to undermine once they've signed on a document. So over here where Rabbi Bar Chana signed on the Shtar Mechira, what right do we have to bring a Moda'ah in over here to bring this other document that remains the sale document? We see here when Edim come and testify to us in court and say that when we signed on the document, it really was not a valid document, they're not believed anymore. So why, if the Edim over there are not believed, why over here in our case do we say that the Moda'ah has power to undermine a sale document signed after the fact or after the declaration of the Moda'ah? So now, their lack of believability over here that Rashbam discusses stems from two factors. One factor is, Ein adam masim etzmo rasha. Person can't make himself into a rasha. Rasha means someone who's lying or someone who's done something incorrect or improper. Over here, as the Rashbam points out, that the Gemara in Ketubot tells us that one is not allowed to sign onto an amana. One is not allowed to sign onto a document which has no tokef, which is not a valid document now, for in case, or that maybe in the future will be a valid document, or a document in reserve, Edim are not allowed to sign on that, and one is not allowed to keep such a document around in their house. We can obviously understand why, because these documents are extremely dangerous. If the person dies, if the person decides all of a sudden to pull out the document, and does not keep his trust with the document, he can exercise the rights that are expressed in the document, and it's a completely valid document. Given that, we don't want those types of documents lying around. We don't want Edim signing on those types of documents. So now when they come and declare to us that they signed on an amana, they signed on such a document, they are being mesimats morasha. They actually are incriminating themselves as acting as Edim improperly. Given that, we won't allow them to testify against themselves in such a manner, in a self-incriminating way. And that's why they're not believed over here, because of that problem. Now, my moda'ah, it's harder to make that argument. It is possible, but it is harder for two reasons. One is, if the Edim themselves were under duress, then it's very hard to say that, because in that instance, they really didn't have much choice, and you can't say that they're really incriminating themselves. You could argue if they knew that the sale was under duress, that they shouldn't have signed on the document. So there, it's possible you could argue that there's also an aspect of Ein Adam Misim Atzmo Rasha, but it is less pronounced than in the case of Amana. In addition, the Rashbam brings down a simple problem, which is this is Kevin Shigid, Shuvenu Choseru Magid. That once Edim have given testimony, they don't have a right to come and undermine that testimony. And that's what's happening over here. When they sign onto the document, when they are Edim to some sort of transaction, they have given testimony to that transaction. because we have Shmuel's position that edim that are found on a document, it's kenechrega edutam bebeitin, as if their testimony has already been validated by the beitin, as if this is considered to be full-fledged testimony. Given that, now when they come after the fact and now want to testify to undermine that which is found in the document, and what they are in essence doing is undermining their previous testimony. And we will not permit them to undermine their previous testimony because, kevin shigid, once a witness has given testimony, he doesn't have a right to perjure himself after that point in time. And that's exactly what this would do. That would perjure his original testimony that's found in the document. And that's what prevents him from coming here and changing his statement. And therefore, enamanim, they are not believed in this instance. Now the Rashbam over here qualifies this statement because there's two ways to have a document validated in terms of the witnesses that are signed onto the document. One way to have them validate the document is for they themselves to come in and say that those are our signatures. And we're telling you that those are our signatures. That's one way to have a document validated. The other way to have a document validated is if we find either other previously validated documents in Beit Din that have their signature on them, and therefore we can compare the signatures and verify that these are proper signatures, or we have other third-party witnesses that come in and testify to the veracity of their signatures. And over here, the Rashbam writes over here, Ein nemanim, that they're not believed, Lo mi bayim tavi adam yotzei mimakam acher. We're not only speaking in a case where we can verify independently their signatures over here, whether because we have other documents that are verified or we have other edim. Dolom hemni lakro. Of course, there, they are not believed, because over there we have independent verification, quote unquote, of their testimony. Given that, they don't have a right now to undermine that testimony. But elo afilu hein atzman mikaimim oto. The Rashbam points out over here, even if they themselves are the validating parties of the signatures, and therefore we would say in this case, pesha asur, they're the ones who are validating the document. And in their validation of the document, they're telling us that it is invalid. So they're the ones who are making it a valid document because of their testimony, telling us it's their signatures. And in the same breath, they're qualifying that and saying that it wasn't right. And that when we signed on it, it wasn't a proper signature. Despite that fact, they are not believed in this case. Because once they have admitted that this document was a valid document, and that they had signed on it properly, it's as if they had testified in Beit Din exactly what is written in the Shtar. So based on that, the Rashbam says that it's irrelevant as to how we get to the validation of this document, whether it's through independent verification or whether it's through the Edim themselves verifying the document. Once we have verified the document, no qualification after the fact will change that, because it's considered as if they are perjuring their previous testimony, and we won't accept that, and therefore the document will stand in Beit Din. And Tosfot says a similar thing over here on the previous Amud. He says, we're speaking in a case where we don't have independent verification of their signatures over here, because as the Rashbam says over there, it's simple, it's pretty straightforward that they're not going to be believed, because we're able to verify or validate the document without them. But even in a case where it's they themselves that are verifying it, we still do not believe them. Because they deem agree that this shtar was valid at some point, shuv lo ati al peh umrar l'shtara. No oral testimony can come and undermine the validity of that shtar. Afilu b'migo. Even with a migo. Even a migo can't undermine it. V'domi nami l'chozrim magidim. Similar to what the Rashbam had said before, edim cannot come and perjure themselves. The Balei Tosafot then go on to explain that we would have to differentiate this from the case where edim show up and say that they, at the time that they were signing the document, they were ktanim, they were minors, anusim, or they were under duress when they signed the document. Because in that case, ein modim klal shashtar nichta bedin. In that point, they do not agree, or they're not validating the document to be a valid document. They're saying that the document itself was pasul, was invalid from the moment it was signed. Because when they signed on it, they weren't valid witnesses. So he says, Hilkach Migo Mahani. In that case, a Migo will help. So the Balei Tosafot make a very clear demarcating line as to when individuals will be believed through a Migo to undermine a Shtar versus when they will not. In a case where the Shtar is a completely valid Shtar, and when they sign on it, if we know that's their signatures, and that's what they're telling us, it is their signatures, then the shtar was considered to be completely valid, and the whole transaction was valid. Now, they themselves are coming to try to undermine that or change that. They can't do that. That's considered to be a perjuring of their previous testimony. On the other hand, if when they're point of validation of the contract, they come and say that the contract was never valid because it was signed by invalid edim, making the contract invalid, then the original contract doesn't really represent any proper testimony. Since it doesn't represent any proper testimony, there's no perjuring of their testimony. In that instance, they will be believed with a migo. So now, based on that, the Gemara is perplexed as to why, in our case, does the moda'a successful at blocking the shtar from going through. My answer is, hani milei alpeh. Wait a minute, over here you're talking about a different situation. You're talking about a oral testimony that's coming to try to undermine a written testimony. Dolaati alpeh umoro l'shtaro. A oral testimony cannot come and invalidate a shtar. Aval b'shtaro, if you have another document, then ati shtaro umoro l'shtaro. That previous document, the document with the moda'a in it, has the capacity or the ability to undermine another shtar. So what in essence we're saying is that the moda'a needs to precede the actual document of sale. And the only way to have that be proven, or the only way for that to be valid, is to have another shtar that is signed. I mean that if you have a shtar moda'a that is predated with their signatures on it, or even other witnesses' signatures on it, that moda'a preemptively prevents the following testimony from being valid testimony. And therefore, since the moda'a was the first testimony, and that is considered to be their first statement, then every other statement after that becomes an invalid statement because of the first statement that they made. And since the moda'a was first, it can undermine the possibility of this shtar mechira being valid. On the other hand, their testimony now is coming to try to undermine something that already happened. The document of sale is considered to be testimony that already happened in the past, and now they are testifying to say it was invalid at the time. It was done under duress. They're now, after the fact, trying to undermine or unwind a contract. Although the Rabbeinu Yonah does ask over here, why don't we see the shtar mechira as being a first line of testimony? And then when the shtar moda'a comes to light after the fact, why isn't that considered to be kevin shigid shuvenu chuzer magid? Similar to oral testimony, where if they came to court to testify about the fact that there was a sale, and then after the fact, they testified to the fact that prior to that, there was a moda'a, we still wouldn't believe them because that is kevin shigid shuvenu chuzer magid. So why don't we say the same thing about written testimony as we say about oral testimony? Whatever comes to court first would be the one that governs, and everything afterwards would be a perjuring of that which was said first, and therefore it could not be undermined. So why should there be a difference between shtarot and the oral testimony? Now the truth is that the easiest way to explain that is that there's a date on the shtar. And the dating on the shtar gives you evidence of the fact that this shtar pre-existed the other shtar. Whereas oral testimony, you always have to question whether, even if they're testifying to that fact, whether it's really true that it preceded the other testimony. But more fundamentally, the Rabbeinu Yonah says that there's a difference between oral testimony and written testimony, which is that oral testimony is only valid once it's brought before the court. A deem's testimony only becomes testimony of the record once the court has accepted their testimony. And therefore, the chronological order of their testimony is important because the later testimony is not a matter of record, whereas the previous testimony is. And so therefore, even if they testify after the fact that something happened previously, their testimony, even though they're testifying about events that took place prior to their previous testimony, it's still not valid because it's only accepted or it becomes a matter of the record when they come and testify. On the other hand, as we said before, when it comes to a shtar has a status of kamish nechugei dutam beitin. It's as if the testimony was already validated and accepted into the record in beitin, and therefore, from the moment that the shtar is signed, it becomes valid testimony. And therefore, the chronological order of the shtarot and when they were signed is very important, because that will determine, really, when they became a matter of record or when the testimony was accepted. Therefore, if the moda'a was signed first, then it became valid first, and it can supersede the contract of sale that came afterwards, even though the court saw the contract of sale first. Other than with oral testimony, doesn't matter that they witnessed an event earlier, and then a later event, the order in which they witnessed isn't as important as when they came to court to give their testimony, because only once their testimony comes to light in court, that's when it gets validity. And therefore, the order of the oral testimony is very important. And if you come and testify about the contract of sale first, and then only afterwards come and testify about the moda'a, we won't accept that second testimony. Gufa. So now the Gemara wants to go back to the statement of Rav Nachman, understand it better, and show us that it's actually a machluk damuraim. Amar Rav Nachman, amana hayu dvareinu, ein nemanim. Moda'a hayu dvareinu, ein nemanim. both of these instances, if the Edim after the fact declare that our signatures on this document were invalid, either because the document was not a documenting an actual sale or an actual loan, but rather put in trust to be used in the future in case there was such an event that took place, or to say that the sale was done under duress, neither of those are accepted after the fact. And as I explained before, either because of the reasons of Ein Adam Masim Etzmo Rasha, or because of the reasons of Kevin Chigid Shuvenu Chuzer Magid. Mar Baravashi argues on this and says, Amana Yudvarenu Ein Nemanim. If they come along and say that Amana Yudvarenu, they are not believed. Moda'a Yudvarenu Nemanim. When they come and say afterwards that it was done, the whole situation, the contract was done under duress, then they are believed. My time, what's the difference between them? Shezeh nitan likatev, vezeh lo nitan likatev. The big difference between them is whether the document can be validly documented and signed, or it cannot be documented and signed. So nitan likatev, according to Rashbam, there's a mitzvah to write a moda'ah to protect the individual, or we actually need the shtar mecher to know how much money exchanged hands over here. And if we're going to invalidate the sale or unwind the sale, we need to know how much money to return. Shtar mecher is actually a documentation of how much money exchanged hands and is helpful to us after the fact, even if we're going to invalidate the sale. Others even say there's an okay or nitan lekatev, the shtar mecher is permitted because there was a shtar moda before it. Therefore, your signing the shtar mecher will not ever be upheld. That's why it's permitted. This goes back to what we spoke about at the beginning of this year, that when it came to the Rabbi Bar Chana signing both on the Moda'ah and then on the document of sale afterwards, we said before there was nothing wrong with him signing on the document of sale because the Moda'ah preceded it, and his signing on the document of sale does not invalidate the Moda'ah. For that reason, that signing on that document of sale is not a problem. And that derives from two reasons. Number one is that the statement or the position of Rav Huna, which is tell you, if they hung him up or strung him up, and then he agrees to sell something, zvine zvine, that is a valid sale. And therefore, a sale under duress is a valid sale, and the witnesses have a right to sign on such a document, because such a sale is a valid sale. So they're signing on the document itself is not invalid. And therefore, when they come along and say that they signed on a document that was done under duress, that is not a Dhamma Simetz Morasha. They're not incriminating themselves in any way because there's nothing wrong with their signing on that document. Now, the fact that there was a Moda'ah, it was done under duress, and there was a declaration beforehand telling that it was done under duress, and the person wants it to be invalid, oh, what about that? Then you still have the problem, Kevin Shigid, Shuvenu Chuzer Magid. So that problem still remains, and we'll have to deal with that in 1 second. On the other hand, when it comes to a Shtar Amana, as the Rashbam points out, there you have a problem of Ein Adam Misim Atzmo Rasha. So even if you could deal with the problem of Kevin Shigid, Shuvenu Chuzer Magid, you'd still always be left with the problem of Ein Adam Misim Atzmo Rasha. And that's what I pointed out before, that with a Shtar Mana, Ein Adam Misim Atzmo Rasha is a much more pronounced problem, which is that you're not allowed to sign on such a document, and an individual's not allowed to keep such a document in his possession. As the Gemara Ketubot says, Al Tishkon Bo'alecha Avla, that you're not allowed to keep in your oil in your house something that is a perversion of justice. Ve'edim avla lo chatme. And edim and witnesses don't sign on something that is a perversion of justice. And therefore, when they testify to the fact that they did sign on such a document, that is a problem of self-incrimination, and therefore we will not accept their testimony. But now you have to deal with the problem of kevin shigid shuvenu chuzer magid. So even if you're able to deal with that, which we'll deal with in 1 second, Shtar Mana will always remain a problem because of Ein Adam Misim Atzmo Rasha. On the other hand, in terms of dealing with the issue of Kevin Shigid Shuvenu Chuzer Magid, what the Rashbam points out over here is that V'afilu Tavi Adam Yotzei Mimakom Acher, even if we can independently validate their signatures from somewhere else, Nemanim, they are believed, De'ein Zeh Chuzer Magid. This is not considered to be a case of perjury. It's not considered to be a case where you testified and now you're recanting your testimony. Ela milta achrite kamisade. They're actually testifying to something completely independent or new. Kandamina namihata chatamnu. We said we signed on it. Aval tanai ayud vareinu. But there was a condition in the signature. Velonit kaim atanai. And that condition was not fulfilled. The milta achrite. It's a totally independent statement. They're not saying that we didn't sign on the document. We're saying we did sign on the document. We're just pointing out that there were other conditions in this loan or there are other circumstances that surrounded this loan. V'nemanim shel shtar meidim shekasher. They're testifying to the fact that the shtar itself is a totally valid shtar. But they're also saying that despite the validity of the shtar, he's not chayav to him anything because either he didn't fulfill the conditions. Over here, the circumstances that surrounded the sale were circumstances that invalidate or do not require him to follow through on the sale. And here the Rashbam says, Ve'echi dami chuzer magid. So where's the case where they would be purging themselves and they actually be changing their testimony? If they say something that invalidates them as witnesses completely on the shtar, in that case, then their testimony is a perjury of the previous testimony, because before, their signature on the document said it was a valid document. Now their testimony is saying it's a completely invalid document. Over there, we would not accept their testimony, because that is considered to be and therefore, if we're able to independently verify their signatures, then they would have no say in the matter. If we're not able to independently verify their signature, then they might be believed by the Migo that we mentioned in the Balei Tosafot earlier. This goes back to something that we saw earlier with regards to Kevin Sheikid, Shuvenu Chuzer Magid, which is we allowed the witnesses to interpret or give interpretation or qualification to their statement as long as it did not completely invalidate that which they said before. That was not considered to be a totally new testimony perjuring their previous testimony, but rather a clarification of their previous testimony. And that's what's happening over here. They're clarifying the fact that when they signed on the document, which was a valid document, nevertheless, it was done under these circumstances or in this situation. That changes the validity of the shtar, not because they didn't sign on it, and not because they're not valid edim on the shtar, but because there are other conditions that make the shtar invalid. And that happens memela, meaning that the shtar itself, they're not directly undermining the shtar, but they rather are, through their complimentary testimony, saying that there were other things surrounding the shtar that make the shtar invalid, but the shtar itself, in of itself, is a valid shtar. So one important part of the Reshbam's position over here, which is not agreed to in other Rishonim, is the fact that even in a case where we can independently verify the Edim signatures over here, we still believe them when they say Modahi. If you look in the Balei Tosafot, they take issue with that and say, Mikomakom. Only when we cannot independently verify or validate their signatures is this true. Nemanim b'migo, they're believed with the migo. Ho v'ein chozrim the gamri meidutam, since they're not backing completely out of their testimony. So the Balei Tosafot see this as being a combination of factors. One is that the only reason that their signatures here are validated is through them. So you have a pesha asur, a pesha itir. And since their altering of their testimony is not a complete alteration, but rather a modification or qualification of their testimony, that's why we allow it to go through. On the other hand, the Rashbam believes that even if we can independently verify their testimony, it's still considered only to be an adjustment in their testimony and not a head-on invalidation of the document. And so given that, they would be believed here even if we can come up with an independent way to verify the document. So now the Gemara moves on in the Mishnah to the next individuals who cannot create a chazakah with each other. We've spoken about an aris, we've spoken about an uman. Now we're going to speak about an ish v'ishto, which is a husband and wife don't have an ability to create a chazakah on each other. Gemara says, pshita, it's pretty straightforward that they should not be able to create a chazakah on each other. Since the husband is entitled to eat the perot off the nichsei malog of his wife, those are pieces of property that she brings into the marriage whereby the husband is entitled to take the output or the leasehold value of that land while they're married. And if they get divorced or he passes away, then the land will return to the wife as part of her ketubah. And they are considered to be the ownership of the wife with the output or the leasehold or the production income going to the husband during the marriage. So the husband's eating of the perot, or the production of the field, is what he's entitled to during the marriage. And therefore, his eating of the perot can never be a validation of a chazakah of purchase, because how are we to know that there was a purchase over here? Why should that validate his purchase if he's entitled to eat this, even if there wasn't a purchase over there? Where it says, Lo tzricha dichtav la din udvarim en li b'nichsayich. The basic idea is that he is rejecting his right to take the perot over here. So it's an instance in where the husband does not have the right to eat the perot, and yet he still is eating the perot. Given the fact that he's eating the perot, it sounds like or seems like he must have established a chazakah here, because otherwise, why is his wife letting him eat the perot if he already said that I'm not going to accept the perot in this instance? So what the Gemara is suggesting over here is even though the husband has waived his right to the perot, and now he's eating peirot, even though he's not entitled to them, he cannot establish a chazak in that way, basically because what the Gemara is going to say upcoming, that the woman is mochel. The nature of the relationship between husband and wife is that the wife, in many of these instances, will not enforce her rights and let her husband take from that which is in the field, or she doesn't want to bother her husband, she doesn't want to start a quarrel over these issues, and therefore she lets her husband take from these items, even though he may not be entitled to them. It says, V'chi katov la mahavi. Even if he writes that language, why does that change any facts? V'atanya, we have a braita. Homer the chaviro, dinu dvarim ein li al sedet zu. If a person writes to his friend, I have nothing to do with this field, ein li esek ba, v'yadai misuleket mimeno. It's not my business, it's not my issue, or I'm taking my hands away from it. Lo mar klum. That language is not valid and has no power to do anything because it fails on all sides. It's not a matana. It's not a granting of an item to another party because over here, the way the language is formulated, it's formulated that you are pulling yourself away from the land, not granting the ownership to another party. So there's no gift, there's no movement of ownership from you to another party. Because all you did was try to remove your own ownership. In addition, the language that you're using is a language that does not have sufficient clarity and strength to make it that you're declaring the land hefker. And therefore, you failed on both sides. You didn't make the land hefker, and you also didn't succeed at transferring the ownership to any other party. So the language in and of itself is a failed language because of the weakness in the way that it is expressed. Given that weakness in the language, why does it matter here that the husband said that I don't want to have anything to do or I'm relinquishing my rights to the peirot and the next day melog? Because that language has no validity. And therefore the husband accomplished absolutely nothing by declaring his relinquishment of his rights to the peirot in that language. So Amrila de Bei Rabbi Yannai, the Bei Rabbi Yannai explained that this language does have validity in certain circumstances. And that is Matnitan Bikotevla Vaudarusa. It's a case where he already relinquished his control, or he gave up his rights while she was still an Arusa. Now why that is important is because when she's an Arusa, he has no rights to the Nechse Malog, and he has no rights to the Peirot of the Nechse Malog. His rights only start once they have Nisuin, once they get married. Given that, then if he, prior to these rights coming into his possession, he uses these language to deny them, he will be successful at relinquishing his rights, or not accepting this item into his possession. We already discussed this earlier in the Gemara, that these languages are not powerful enough or not legally binding when it comes to something that's already in your possession. That's why they fail. But on the other hand, if you use these languages before the item reaches your possession, you have the ability to block it coming into your possession through these following languages. So that's what we're constructing over here is a case where prior to his accepting of the Nechse Malog, or prior to the Nechse Malog, or the Peirot, the next Melo coming to his possession, he says, no thanks, I don't want them. And therefore, he is able to block them from coming into his possession. And that's the Chiddush of our Mishnah. Despite the fact that he relinquished his control over those Peirot, and he did not accept them at the time of Nisuin, even if he eats Peirot after that fact, we will not grant him a chazakah because of the nature of relationship between a husband and wife, or basically this idea that a woman will forgive or look the other way when it comes to her husband taking these fruits because of their marriage or because of the fact she wants to make her husband happy, even though he has no legal right to these peirot. Given that she would do that, we can't establish a chazakah in that manner. Now, the Baal Tosafot make 2 points over here. One is based on the Gemara's conclusion, the Gemara Ketubot, simply saying, dinat dvarim mainly b'nechsayich would not be sufficient. You would have to add on other language after that, which includes peirotehem or pered peirotehem. There are other languages that we'd have to add on. The Gemara here is just giving you the base language, and you have to go to the Gemara Ketubot to figure out what the proper language is. Number two is that the Baal Tosafot do point out that the Gemara had many other alternatives to give an answer over here. They leave it as a tzarech iyun. They don't give us a complete answer to this, but they note over here that the Gemara had alternatives. Instead of saying that he used this weak language, and it was at a time that she was an Arusa, he could have said that he used proper language. He gave away the peirot, or gave the peirot back to his wife with the proper language that said as if it was a matana. I'm gifting you these back. I'm giving you back your rights to the peirot. In that case, it would be completely valid, and you would end up in the same situation in which the husband has no rights to the peirot. Oh, inami shnatnu la'amanat shein lebala reshupa, where someone granted her the property with a condition that her husband has no rights in the property. Oh, shnatan la'bala, or an instance when the husband himself gave the property to his wife where he doesn't retain or he doesn't have rights then to the payroll. The Tosfot says you have a whole bunch of other options here in terms of solutions, and therefore it's interesting that the Gemara picked this solution, but wasn't necessarily the only solution that the Gemara could have come up with. So there's some that want to answer that. The reason the Gemara didn't go in that way or in that fashion is because if the payroll were granted in a full-fledged gift, then that shows a certain amount of hakpadah by the wife, and if she is makpid, and they are transacting in a way that takes away his rights in a very formal and legal manner, maybe or that's a demonstration of the one big makpedet, and therefore, if husband did eat payroll after that, we would not say that it's not a chazaka. Maybe we would grant him a chazaka in that case. Or you could argue that the Gemara wanted to come on to the following chiddush that's going to come up in the Gemara afterwards, explain to us when exactly does this language work. Because we said before that the language of Dinei Devarim, Einli Benichsayich, basically says that I'm not going to be involved. I'm not going to quarrel. I'm not going to argue about these pieces of property. Again, it's a failure. It's not a Lashon Matanah. It's not a Lashon Hefker. But despite that fact, we know that it works in this circumstance, which is in a circumstance where the right or the legal ownership has yet to reach the husband. He has, using this language, can stop that right or legal ownership from coming into his possession. So that's the Chiddush of the Gemara to teach us this point. And then the Gemara now is going to go on to give us qualifications or to limit the scope of when that works. Ucha de Rav Kahana. And the first qualification is that of Rav Kahana. Damar Rav Kahana. Nachala balo le'adam mimakom acher. A person inherits something coming from a different location, meaning that it's coming from some other party or some other way. Then, adam matne'alav shlo yirshenu. Person can block that Yusha from coming into his possession. Uche de Rava, and also qualified by Rava, Dama Rava. Kol Omer, Yevshi betakanat chachamim kigon zot, shomim lo. Anytime a person denies or declines a takanat chachamim, he has a right to do so. My kigon zot, what does it mean similar to this? What is the context in which this was said? Kedravuna, Amarav. Like the situation that Ravuna Barav explained to us, Dama Ravuna Marav, Yuchala Isha shete Amar de Bala. A woman has a right to say to her husband, "Eni nizonit, I do not want you to take care of me, provide for me mizonot, veni osa, and I will also not have production or my income will not accrue to your benefit." So let's work our way backwards through all of these statements. First, the statement of Huna Marav, which is that a woman has a right to deny that takanat chachamim. The chachamim in her ketubah granted her the right to get mizonot from her husband. The quid pro quo for her receiving the mizonot are her maseh yadayim. So underlying Rav Huna Amarav's statement is that the takana was for the benefit of the woman, and therefore the right of the woman to get mizonot is the ikar part of the takana. The secondary piece is that quid pro quo for that, her income, or her production accrues to her husband. And so therefore, the woman is in the control seat over here, and she can make a determination as to whether she wants it or not. Again, it's similar to a penalty in football, where a team can decide whether the penalty is to their benefit, or where their gains are greater without the penalty, they can decline the penalty. So over here, the woman can make a decision. Is taking the mizonot to her benefit? Or maybe her income or her production far exceed the value of the mizonot? Therefore, she'll decline this takanat chachamim, and fend for herself and say, you keep the mizonot, and I'll keep my own income, and I'll be in a better situation. I'm happy to do that. So a woman has a right to make such a declaration. So that's the context in which Rava's statement says is made, which is kagon zot. Like a situation that is mentioned by Amar Rav Yehuna Amar Rav, Rava says in those types of situations where you have a takanat chachamim, you have a right to declare that you do not want it, or you don't want it coming into your possession. And that's what the Rashbam says over here. You can now extrapolate from that din of mizonot, where the husband has to provide for his wife, and quid pro quo, he receives her maseh yadayim. The similar thing is true by the perot of nechzei melog. When it comes to the fruits, or the production, or the output of the land of the nechzei melog that come into the marriage, those also have a quid pro quo, which is the husband receives the perot, and quid pro quo for that, he redeems his wife. He promises if she's taken into captivity that he will redeem her. Reginu Gershom also mentioned Kvura over here that he's obligated to bury her or pay for her burial. So over there, since the takana is put in place, and in that case, the obligation was done in favor of the husband, and the husband basically has the obligation to take care of his wife, and in exchange for that, he's granted the right to the perot nechzei melog. The husband could say, I'm not interested in the perot nechzei melog. Therefore, she can fend for herself in terms of her redemption, and she can fend for herself in terms of her kvura. She'll use her peyrot niksei malog to pay for that, and I don't want her peyrot niksei malog. And so what the Rashbam says is, in this situation too, the husband can deny or can block that takanat chachamim from going into effect. The Baal Yad Tosafot over here disagree with the Rashbam on two fronts. First premise of the Rashbam is that the takana is in favor of the husband, and the husband is the decisor over here as to whether to accept the peyrot niksei malog or not to accept the peyrot niksei malog. The second thing is that the right of the husband to block it or to decline this takana in his favor. The Baal Yad Tosafot argue on both of those points, and he brings from the Rashbam that, first of all, he thinks that the controlling party here is the woman, and that the woman's benefit is what counts. She's the one who gets to decide here. If she decides she wants the redemption, and if she decides she wants the burial, then she has to give quid pro quo her nixay malog. And therefore, she would be the controlling party, and she could be the one who makes the decision. But then the Baal Yad Tosafot go on to say that despite the fact that it's in her control, she does not have a right to do it. And that is because we don't want this woman getting stuck if she's taken into captivity and then not getting out. Because if she denies this relationship or quid pro quo with her husband, then nobody's going to redeem her from captivity. And then she's going to go and be left. Even though it was put in place for her benefit, we don't want her getting stuck amongst the goyim and never being redeemed. That's not an outcome that we want. Meaning, as a society, we don't want that outcome. Given that, we were going to compel both parties to abide by this takanat chachamim, even though the woman is in control and should technically be able to decline it or deny it. Second thing he points out is that it's not similar to mizonot, which is that mizonot is the type of thing that you can turn on and turn off, which means that the woman can say, I don't want mizonot, so you don't get my masei yadayim. Then later on, or 5 years later, she could say, I want mizonot, and I'll give you my masei yadayim. It's something that you can move around, you can change. It doesn't, once you deny it or decline it, doesn't mean you can't reinstate it at a later date. But then when it comes to pirkona and kvurata, these are types of, we'll call them one-time events in a life. Obviously, kvura is only a one-time event. Even though pirkona could happen many times, these are infrequent events. And therefore, the granting quid pro quo is that the husband gets the peyrot of nixa melog for the entirety of their marriage. So therefore, there's no way to turn it on and off. And if you decline it, it's turned off permanently. It's what the Baal Yad Tosafot point out. In that instance, you're basically eliminating the takanat chachamim completely. That we won't accept. By mizonot, which even if you decline it, it may be only be a temporary declining of the takanat chachamim, because you can reinstate it later. Therefore, it's not considered to be at odds with the takanat chachamim. This is very similar to an argument that's made with regards to the difference between mechirat chametz and the heter mechir that's used by shmita. Is that the heter mechir that's used by shmita completely undermines the shmita? It completely removes the concept of shmita, and that's why people are not generally inclined to use it or favor using that heter mechira. On the other hand, when it comes to Mechirat Chametz acknowledges the problem of the Isur Chametz and uses a mechanism to get you out of the problem by taking the Chametz out of your possession. But it acknowledges the fact that the Chametz is Asur, as versus the Heter Mechira, which allows you to work the land and completely ignore the Shemitah. And so the Tosafot makes a similar distinction between the Mizonot and the Peirot and Nechsei Malog, that one of them is a complete undermining of the Takanat Chachamim, versus the other one, which is a circumvention or a temporary circumvention, still acknowledges the existence of that relationship and allows it to be turned on again. Then it also gives a third reason to differentiate between them. He says, Inami, Shani Peirot Mishum Yadok Yada Shuzoche Begufa Karka. In that case, the husband's rights to the Peirot are almost instantaneous, which is that he has the right to take possession of the land to garner the output of the land. So there is something tangible for him to make a kinyan on, in order to garner the output of the land. On the other hand, when it comes to Masei Yadayim, it's a completely intangible concept, even though the Gemara in Ketubot discusses the fact that her Yadayim are the tangible aspect of it, it's still a very intangible object, and he doesn't take possession of the woman where he can say he gets her output. So given that, there's also a difference over there where the husband's veto rights by the Mizonot are completely limited, whereas his veto rights by the Nixlei Malog might be much stronger, because of his ability to take, in a sense, joint ownership of the land, because it's ownership for the output of the leasehold on the land. Given that difference, the mizonot and masei yadayim can be shut off by the woman, but the case of the peirot and pirkonah, she can't shut it off because the husband, in a sense, has a veto right to that because of his ownership or underlying ownership in the land for its output. So the Rashbam over here, it seems like the Rabbeinu Gershom says something similar, believe that both of these Takanat Chachamim are subject to this din of Rava, where the party has a right to waive their rights granted them Chachamim, both by the case of Mizonot and Maaseh Yadeh, which is in the hand of the woman, and the case of Perot Malog, either according to the Rashbam in exchange for Pirkuna, the redemption of the woman if she's taken into captivity, the husband has the right to decide over there. From the Reginu Gershom, it's not clear who has the decision, but he says that the Perot Nixei Malog are traded off with Kvurata, and whether it's the husband or the wife's decision, it seems that they could waive that right. Vayitas would agree with regards to Mizonot and Maaseh Yadayim, but with regards to Nixei Perot Milug, they disagree, both fundamentally in the fact that it's the woman's right and not the husband's right. And number two is, even though it's the woman's right, they still don't have a right to decline this Takana Chachamim. This Takana Chachamim, in a sense, is a societal Takana, or it's a Takana that we don't want to undermine completely, or because there's an ownership right of the husband in the land, for all those reasons, the wife doesn't have a right to turn this takana off or decline this tovam in the chachamim. Yeah, I was even moved back through the memorial that were brought over here. Rav Huna Marav explained for us what is the circumstance and situation where one has the right to exercise a declining of a right or a benefit that's coming into their hand is based on these dinim derabanan. Now, what's important is that Rava's statement says that we're governed by that which is said by Rav Huna Marav, which is that it is a takanat chachamim. And in that way, the Rashbam differentiates between a case of rights midrabanan or Yerusha midrabanan versus a case of Yerusha de Oraita. And he says that what Rava's statement teaches us here is the fact that this is only true in Dine derabanan, whether it's takanat derabanan or possibility Yerusha derabanan, which is that if the Yerushata Baal, the inheritance of a husband of his wife's possession, is only considered to be derabanan, it's a machloket, whether it's derabanan, deraita, but at least according to one who says it's derabanan, then in those cases, the Baal has the right to declare that he won't accept that right, or he will deny his benefit in those situations. And that's why the husband over here has the ability to say, I will not accept the payrot that are coming into my possession. But other than when it comes to Yerushata Raita, where it's a Yerusha that's been passed from a father to a son, over there the Torah declares the ownership is coming into your possession, you don't have a right to deny that or to block that, because that's not your choice. That's something that's going to happen automatically, because the Torah declares that's the way that Yerusha moved. Although the Rashba over here makes a different distinction than the Balei Tosafot and the Rashbam, who differentiate between Nachla d'Oraita and Nachla d'Rabbanan. Rather, he says it has to do with whether the Nachla is a natural derivative of your blood relationship, or is the nachla derivative of your action, meaning nisuin? Did marriage generate it? If marriage generated the nachla that's coming into your possession, you have a right to deny that zchut, whether it's d'oraita or d'rabanan, you have a right to relinquish your rights to that or deny it. On the other hand, if it is something that comes from your natural familial relationship, over there you don't have a right to decline it because it's an outcome of your relationship, not something that you created. And therefore, it'll come into your possession, whether you like it or not, and you can't deny the Yerusha coming into your possession. Again, irrespective of whether it's d'oraita or d'rabanan. The Balei Tosafot point out that what is the chiddush of Rav Kahana? Rav Kahana's chiddush, according to the Balei Tosafot, is, milte de Rava luchude lo sagi velo de Rav Kahana. If we just had the statement of Rava, we wouldn't be able to learn without Rav Kahana. De me Rava lo avi shaminan. From Rava, we would not know. That you have a right to create this condition for something that is yet to come into the world. It's a future right. It's a future thing that is going to come to you. The Rava Kaya Mizonot. Because Rava is speaking about a case of Mizonot. Shalom Ba'li Olam. They have yet to come into the world. That is a future right that you are entitled to. And we see from Rava, you have a right to deny that or to decline that right, even though it's something in the future. That from Rava, you would not know the fact that something in the future, you could deny that right or decline that right. Even though Rava is speaking about a case of Mizonot, which is something that is yet to come into the world, ain't no chidush. That's not a chidush. It's no chidush that she doesn't have Mizonot. She has to take Mizonot. Meaning that this is not a right that we're going to force upon her. It's not a right that we're going to give to her and impose upon her. If she doesn't want mizonot, why should we force her? Why should she have to take mizonot if she doesn't want them? And if she wants to back out or change her mind anytime, it's fine. Meaning that Rav Huna's chiddush is not that she can shut down the mizonot, but rather that she has the ability to withdraw her maaseh yadayim. So the davar shelo ba'alei olam with regards to the mizonot is not the chiddush in Rav Huna's statement. The chiddush in Rav Huna's statement
is the fact that she, when deciding that she doesn't want the mizonot, can also pull her masei yadayim. So from that, we can't learn anything about declining a future right. Because, of course, we're not going to feed her mizonot against her will. So, of course, she can decline that. And the only question is, and that's what Rav Huna is telling us, is her right then to withdraw her masei yadayim. So that's not her declining a right, but rather withholding a right from another party. So what Rav Kahana comes to teach us is that you have a right to decline a right coming into your possession, even though it is a davar shelo bali olam. And that you would not have known from Rabbi Yanai, because Rabbi Yanai himself is of the position that you're allowed to be makneh davar shelo bali olam. And so what Rav Kahana adds for us is, despite the fact that we hold ein adam makneh davar shelo olam, that does not have application over here, and one has the right to be misalek, to remove themselves or deny a right coming to the possession, even though it's a lo bali olam, and that is not integrally connected to the position of adam makneh davar shelo bali olam, which you would have surmised from the position of Rabbi Yanai. And so that is the chiddush of Rav Kahana.
Therefore, the Baal Tosafot see a complementary position that derives from Rav Kahana and Rova. Rav Kahana teaches us, according to the Ri, Nira, the mighty Raya, the afakav the kaimelan, deni adam makneh davar shelo bali olam, even though we are of the opinion or belief that a person cannot acquire something that has yet to come into the world, he can remove himself or he can release himself from something that has yet to come into the world. That's the chiddush of Rav Kahana. Rova comes and qualifies that and says that's only true when we're dealing with dinei derabbanan. That is not true when we're dealing with dinei deoraita. So he sees Rav Kahana and Rova being complementary statements, and that's what it's teaching us, that Rova is qualifying Rav Kahana's statement. But Rav Kahana is giving us the Ikar principle, which is that you're allowed to deal with things that are intangible, things that are in the future. You're allowed to deny those rights from coming into your possession. In addition, the Rabbeinu Yonah adds that Rava also teaches us that this declining or relinquishing or declining of rights can happen even after Nisuin, meaning that the husband has a right to remove himself from privileges that he gets even after the time that they're in Nisuin, like the future Nichsei Malog that he would have gotten, or the future Mizonot that the woman would have gotten. So the Chiddush of Rova is that you can even have these declining of those benefits after the point of Nisuin.
And the reason over here that we set it up, it was a case by Oda Arusa, is because she already had possession of the properties. That inheritance or those Nichsei Malog were already in her possession. But if there were in the future to be Nichsei Malog that possibly would come into her possession, he could deny that right even after Nisuin.
Therefore, each one of these statements of the Amorim adds an additional aspect to that which we are saying over here. Rav Kahana teaches us that you have the ability to deny, relinquish a right, or decline a benefit that is coming in the future, even though you can't acquire things that are in the future.
So Rav is coming to do one of three things. Either he's coming to affirm the position of Rav Kahana, to say that Rav also paskins like Rav Kahana, or he's coming to qualify for us as to when Rav Kahana applies.
According to the Rashbam and the Baal Tosafot, that means it's a difference between whether it's a Nachla d'Oraita or Nachla d'Rabbanan, or we saw in the Rashba, the possibility of the difference between Nachla that comes from your blood relationship versus a relationship that is through marriage.
Or to teach us that Rav Kahana's statement is not limited to Ba'od Arusa, but even applies in the time of Nisuin, as long as the right has yet to reach his possession. And that would include whether it's his inheritance of his wife or Nichsei Malug that would come in the future into her possession.
And Rav Huna Amarav comes to teach us this fundamental idea that you have a right to deny a Takanat Chachamim when it's to your benefit.